This is a podcast from the AHRC ICT Methods Network at www.methodsnetwork.ac.uk.
Solutions, discovering solutions, and I want to recap all those solutions this morning as problems. I also want to, I want to apologize for avoiding all technology whatsoever. I don't even have a PowerPoint display, and I feel terrible about it. I would feel terrible about it if I hadn't done it purposely on the ground, but that's part of the point. As a social practice, history in the post-Enlightenment West and East and South represents a powerful claim to authority. As a profession, academic historians have created a subtle language of authentication and authenticity that inextricably ties together the hierarchies of the academy with a particular research methodology and the outward signs of a trusted textual representation, or every system is designed to ensure that a broader society recognizes the authority of a monograph on 17th century poor relief based on a detailed reading of parish records, published by CUP and written by a fully paid-up member of academic staff at a reputable, preferably old university. This overstates the restrictions we place on the genre, and I'm certain that intellectual and cultural historians and 20th century historians will happily object that I'm unnecessarily excluding their own practices. But it's also substantially true. We live in a world where appearances and appearances of authority are all important. Since at least the early 19th century, history has been built into a kind of social science with rules and expectations that are embedded in every sentence, every paragraph, and most obviously in every footnote we write, and which has then been monopolized within an ever more rigid institutional framework, the academy. This evolution has then been reinforced by the creation of an increasingly uniform and professional set of local, regional, and national archives. When that pioneer of the county archive movement, F.G. Emerson, rode his bike from parish to parish across Essex and East Anglia, chronicling the contents of each parish chest, he was essentially contributing to the creation of a body of professional historical practice based in a particular kind of manuscript research. Of course, in just the last 40 years or so, this body of professional practice has been confronted by the corrosive force of postmodernism, which has had an impact on both the role of the public intellectual, and how we read and write history. It has forced us to question the validity of history as a truth claim, and to query the methodologies that underpin it. It has also made us covet the high profile, public profile, and not incidental film star good looks of the Derridas and Christivas of this world. Primary texts have been revealed as elaborate constructs, with only the most ambiguous relationship to knowable truth, and secondary works have emerged as literary confections in which truth claims are embedded in both the use of language and the layout of passive prose on a clear page. The choice of font, the amount of white space, the presence or absence of a simple serif, the weight of paper and type of binding all form a series of interlocking claims to authority which have to some extent been unpacked, and which become more complex and more obvious with every attempt to encode the content of any given page. The interesting thing is that despite the ups and downs, the insights and absurdities of the historiographical navel-gazing of the last 40 years, and the explosion of subdisciplines which accompany it, the majority of historians remain wedded to and practice an older style of history writing that would be as familiar to Karl Marx as it is to us. The difficulty is that the habits of mind and more explicit methodological content of this tradition are increasingly at odds, it seems to me, with the course of technological change, particularly the developments of search engines of the sort that we've just seen demonstrated. In essence, I think it's important to recognize that our commitment to at least the appearance of an empiricism impacts dramatically on the content of historical writing. Both the methodologies of the social sciences and the evolution of the profession have effectively given prominence to specific types of information and relationships that privilege organic archives interpreted by professionally trained individuals as the source of a legitimate truth. As a result, we are unconsciously led to give unwarranted prominence to the institutions of past societies in preference to groups and individuals defined in more inchoate ways, who did not leave well-structured archives. We also expect, as part of our claim to authority, that historians should be absolute masters of the archives they use. The role of archives in creating the cultural authority deployed by historians is essentially visceral and emotional in character. It seems to me that what we are confronted with is a very powerful set of practices that is not even intellectualized. It is about our relationship to the material world that we work in. That first moment, when it's perhaps an undergraduate, you are delivered up the paper and parchment remains of a long dead generation, is an immensely powerful one that historians frequently romanticize and which forms a slightly hackneyed element of a large number of prefaces. Nevertheless, there is something about walking out of an archive at the end of the day, your clothes and hands dark with rotting paper and the dust of decades, that provides an emotional link to the past. When you unwrap the parchment document, closing perhaps a 200-year-old bit of evidence given to the coroner's inquest, and the sand used to blot the original text spills into your lap, it's difficult to maintain an appropriate distance, regardless of whether that distance is postmodern or empirical in character. Even when dealing with the carefully conserved documents of record given prior to place in national repositories, there's something special about manuscript and the physical process of reading manuscript evidence. It is emotional, it's attractive, but it's also very real. And if you explore the footnotes of the texts which fill the bibliographies of your third year special subjects, if you unpick the definition of historical research used by the RAE, it is precisely this loving relationship to manuscript authority which underpins our claims to intellectual privilege. The most impressive footnotes in any monograph are the archival ones. We judge good scholarship by its engagement with manuscript, and distrust histories made more intellectually free-floating by its absence. And when we endeavor to convey the essence of our profession to our undergraduate students, we most frequently fall back on an introduction to structured sources. The image of history we currently teach is sharply polarized between a self-conscious body of professional opinion, historiography, and an ever-growing emphasis on original sources. The problem is, at the moment, we're in the process of changing the nature of that object of study, changing the nature of the manuscript sources upon which we rely. Digitization, new search facilities, new ways of representing and connecting information fundamentally changes the nature of the archive. What it means, how it's used, how we as historians experience it. It is very different looking at information on a screen, looking at information extracted from an organic archive, than it is sitting in front of a body of rotting paper. And if our claims to cultural authority are built on a relationship with that archive, then it behooves us to pay attention. And there are two aspects of these developments that I want to discuss this morning. The first is a problem familiar, it seems to me, from the digitization of the corpus of printed works over the last decade. Billions of words of printed historical texts are now available in a keyword searchable form. It's now commonplace to use keyword searching in order to locate information on topics that do not normally appear in a 19th or 20th century index, or a good card catalog, or even a well-developed concordance. Ebo and Echo, the Times Online, the Million Book Project, the Gutenberg Project, and even the Old Bailey Online make printed texts easily available and have, in 10 years, essentially destroyed 300 years of library science. In the process, it has also had a profound impact on the way literary and historical scholars go about doing research. The number of historians who are now using literary sources to round out their more factual accounts is growing, and the number of literary scholars who are discovering the joys of contextualizing literature within history is ever expanding. This trend is entirely dependent on the fact that you can now perform keyword searches on billions of words of printed text, both literary and historical. History conferences are becoming more literary, while literature conferences are becoming significantly more historical. It's particularly true for those working on English sources for the period before 1800. A simple measure of the change can be found by walking into the British Library any day of the week. I don't know if the statistics demonstrate it, but I no longer have to deal with the disappointment of finding my favorite seat in the rare books room occupied by some callow research student from Bloomington, Indiana. If they are not sitting at home in front of their computer. They are all sitting outside with their laptops in front of them with a Wi-Fi connection interrogating the internet. The same kind of transformation in scholarly practice is also happening in relation to images. Art history used to be the highly specialized backwater, a profession invented, as far as I can tell, to employ the younger children of the very rich. But as collection after collection goes online, historians who used to trawl out the same tired old image year after year, book cover after book cover, or who ignored them entirely, have suddenly discovered the ability to use graphic representation in support of their text. 10 years ago, when running a seminar series, perhaps one or two speakers would request a slide projector and be roundly condemned for having done so, while the ever-difficult demographers would always demand an overhead projector. Now, the large majority of speakers, with the exclusion of myself, ask for a visualizer and use images as well as tables. The same transformation is just beginning in relation to the integration of material and museum objects into analysis and reflects the direct intellectual impact of new search facilities. In other words, keyword searching of printed text and by proxy of picture collection has begun to dramatically impact on how we do research and has demonstrably impacted on what we research about. And in the process, it's resulted in the substantial deracination of knowledge. The uprooting, the Googleization of the components of what was once a coherent collection of beliefs. Historians are now expected to search across a large number of different electronic sources and to deploy fragments of knowledge in the creation of a new analysis. We choose search terms or a collection of terms and search indiscriminately through literature and the records of crime, through electronic catalogs and newspapers. In the process, the requirement or even the opportunity to understand the context out of which any individual element of information comes disappears. Images suffer this fate even more completely than text. They're deployed as evidence with wild abandon and almost no consideration of provenance or purpose. The heady hierarchy of knowledge created by the heroic catalogers of the 19th century has become, to a large extent, an irrelevance. In many respects, however, this development has been less corrosive than you might at first sight imagine. It has ensured that thematic history is ever more commonplace. But this was a trend discernible from at least the 1980s, if not long before, and was itself a response to the breakdown of broader historical meta-narratives, and in particular Marxism. Histories of cod and nighttime, of gesture and salt, were conceived before the internet made them easier to write. Arguably, the authority of text itself has declined in response to these developments. We don't respect publishers very much anymore. And the purpose of books seems to grow ever more elusive. But few people have questioned the broader project of writing history, and on balance, most people seem to view the internet and the ability to search large bodies of text as a largely unproblematic good thing. We're now, however, faced with a rather different agenda and a different set of possibilities. Up until now, almost no substantive manuscript archives have been actually posted in a full and searchable form. And even where attempts have been made to do so, little effort has been put into breaking down the archival structures involved. Most attempts to represent archival material have sort of taken the form of databases which amplify the structures and divisions inherent in any given collection. But over the next 10 years, it seems to me this is bound to change. The impediments, largely managerial, to posting large volumes of manuscript in a searchable form have disappeared, as the managerial and technical challenges of doing so have been gradually solved. The project that Bob Shoemaker and I are just beginning, with the help of Mark and the HRI, Plebeian Lives and the Making of Modern London, for example, will eventually post 70 million words of manuscript encompassing 8 freestanding organic archives, all tied in to the by then 75 million words of Old Bailey text. It'll take 3 parish archives, the records of the Carpenters' Company, of Bedlam and Bridewell, of St. Thomas's Hospital, and the Sessions Papers of the counties of Middlesex and the City of London, and transcribe every word from scanned images captured from 530-odd reels of microfilm, all of which will then be searchable in combination with the distributed resources of the voting and tax records of Westminster, all those distributed archives which Fabio and Mark have just described. where was I? And all of which will be available through History Online and the HRI. Anyway, the point is there are a lot of data sets. They will all be included. These will be a series of freestanding archives that are complete and comprehensive. And the point is that there's just a lot of stuff. It is a huge body of different sources located in different places, which is being brought together in an entirely artificial and new way. It's perhaps a small project by comparison to Evo and Echo, but it reflects our own decision to make the obvious shift from printed materials to manuscript, and is the sort of transition that I know is being pursued by many other groups around the country and around the world. In other words, within a few years, in addition to all the printed texts, a substantial proportion of that massive archive held in local record offices will be available for the kind of keyword searching and data mining that we're currently doing. But more important, this new body of digitized manuscript will also be available for this new kind of searching. The development of an ontological search engine for use with this material substantially extends the deracination of knowledge inherent in keyword searching, and once applied to archival manuscript sources will effectively remove another prop from our claim to professional expertise. The distance between the archive as a physical entity and the ways in which we use it will simply have increased that much further. I believe that the impact of this is likely to be at least as profound as the changes we've already witnessed in relation to keyword searching of printed text. But there's a real possibility that they could be even more dramatic. Arguably, if keyword searching makes nonsense of the Dewey Decimal System and the Library of Congress, ontological search engines applied to large numbers of manuscript sources undermines and transforms the nature of our understanding of historical change itself. When discussing the nature of knowledge, the inherent assumptions that exist in archival structures are seldom explicitly discussed. But it seems to me that the hierarchical and institutional nature of most archives contains an ideological component which we naturally suck in with every dust-filled breath, and which informs our worldview at a basic level. To see how digitization of manuscript materials in combination with new types of search engines could impact on the nature of history, it's necessary, it seems to me, to think a bit about the structure of organic archives and how we work with them. In its most commonplace formulation, the archive had lasted from the Renaissance to the day before yesterday. It gradually changed, but even within the memory of most people sitting in this room, an archive took much the same form as it had in the 16th century. There were day books and monthly accounts, books recording the minutes of a hierarchy of meetings, and perhaps letter books and strings of miscellaneous receipts. If you were dealing with a hospital or a workhouse, you might find admissions registers and medical notebooks. But the important thing is that the vast majority of the archives were created to administer specific institutions and took a recognized and hierarchical form. In their original location, they were spread through pigeonholes and cubbyholes. The 19th century roll-top desk, with its many slots and drawers organized above a writing platform, forms the classic physical statement of archival organization, combining both the security of a firmly closed top with the organizational specificity of its many compartments. But even when transferred to the tender mercies of a professional archive, even once the living beast of archival construction is slain and stuffed, ready for our examination, it retains a power to determine how it should be read. And the reading it demands is one that privileges institutions. Whether the archive is of a government, a business, an estate, or a charity, the object of study naturally becomes the institution itself, and gives that institution a lurid clarity to the eye of a historian. Some archives were created by a single clerk, while others were the output of a number of hands. But in either case, the archive, by its nature, expressed the perspective of the institution. The persons whose voice we most frequently hear whispering among the folios is that of the clerk. As a result, we give greater weight to the role of governments and armies, parishes and hospitals, precisely because they form coherent archives. At the same time, we denigrate loose communities and informal connections because they do not speak with a single voice. There have, of course, been large numbers of attempts to circumvent this inevitable bias towards a vision of the past determined by archival coherence. Arguably, the new historicism, the new cultural history of the 70s and 80s, the anthropological history of the sort pioneered by Keith Thomas, was intended to do just this, to reconfigure our perspective and escape the clutches of the creator of the archive. I don't think, however, that these approaches really worked. After the first generation of scholars who themselves had been thoroughly schooled in institutional research, the next generation found themselves either flailing in an ill-defined intellectual morass with no clear body of evidence, well, seduced back into the archive. In some respects, keyword searching and published texts has made this approach more possible, but the inherently elitist nature of print has limited the impact even here. If we step back for a moment and think about the major explanatory narratives and meta-narratives that inform Western history, the impact of archival structures seems to me self-evident. Most history has been the story of the evolution of the state in its many forms. Whether we are talking about Gibbon or Namier, the management and development of the state forms the core subject. Arguably, this is a natural outcome of the state's tendency to control its own archives. The existence of a national archive ensures that most historians will have access to the state's perspective. But even if we look at social and economic or cultural intellectual history in its apparently least statist form, the impact of archival structures remains. The figures in Edward Thompson's Making the English Working Class, whose actions and personalities most distinctly emerge from the text, are those who made it into the files of the informer's reports, and are described not unsympathetically or necessarily inaccurately from the perspective of the clerk. The questions asked and the answers given were the product of an intellectual agenda long dead. And however compelling Thompson's storytelling skills were, and however sympathetic and empathetic his writing, he nevertheless told a story of change that the clerk himself would have recognized. Even in history more thoroughly inflected with a cultural twist, such as Habermas's formulation of the evolution of the public sphere, it is only by personifying change in the form of an institution, the coffeehouse, that the transformation of social attitudes can be described. In intellectual history, we study societies and libraries. In medical history, hospitals and infirmaries. And every time we walk through the door of a new archive, we are seduced all over again. But the impact of archival structures is more subtle than this. Most explanations are essentially dialectical in formulation. They pit one force against another, or perhaps, if you're very clever, three together. And it is the institutions of past societies that form the shorthand in that confrontation. The conflict between capital and labor in a Marxist perspective becomes a conflict between businesses and unions, however inchoate. When rebellion occurs, the rebels are quickly reconceptualized as an organized force, and then forced to become one under the pressure of a state demanding someone to negotiate with. In other words, it is the archives themselves which lead ineluctably to the deep structures of analysis we apply to the past. At a fundamental level, we are confronted with the limitations of being the ventriloquist dummy to the archival clerk. In some respects, that is no bad thing. As historians, it allows us to achieve at least one of the many purposes of history writing. It allows us to speak for and memorialize the experience of at least some of the dead. But at the same time, it exists in stark tension with another purpose of history, the explanation of the process of change. If we allow institutions to stand in for the forces at work at any given moment, we inevitably downplay the role and definitions of individuals and groups. Even if we believe that a society's institutions do in fact define and describe it, or pull together individual agency into an effective force for historical change, traditional professional research methods lead us to locate change and agency in the interstices between the letter book and the day book in the institution, rather than in the minds of clients and participants. The impact of the digitization of organic archives in combination with the fundamental deracination of knowledge implied by the use of ontologies frees us from the habit of mind implied by the very structures of the archives. In other words, if keyword searching of digitized print has broken down the boundaries between genre and categories, The equivalent digitization of manuscript archives will tend to eliminate the assumptions about how we think societies work at a most basic level. By way of historical metaphor, we are confronted with the difference between a medieval strip map on which a single route is charted to an otherwise unknowable territory, on which a single journey from Norwich to London is represented in linear fashion from landmark to landmark, to a perspective map on which we are expected to chart our own journey on the basis of a wider knowledge of the territory. At least metaphorically, we have ceased to be pilgrims and become explorers. Where a strip map asks you to imagine a journey, perspective map asks you to imagine a landscape. And in terms of explanations of social change, that is exactly what the next program of digitization will demand. Between them, keyword searching and printed texts in combination with the melting away of archival structures, at least in relation to how we experience them, radically transforms the nature of what we do, and it does so in two ways. First, it fundamentally undermines several versions of our claim to social authority and authenticity as interpreters of the past. When we cease to claim a special expertise in a particular archive, a fundamental pillar of the justification for our existence ceases to exist. If we are there to speak for the archives, our role is largely finished, as the material they contain is newly liberated and endlessly replicated. And as soon as, of course, the archivists stop allowing us to handle the originals once they've been posted on the internet. Like librarians before us, we are confronted with the need to redefine what we do and why, and justify anew to a doubting society our purpose within it. Second, this development also challenges us to re-examine the broad meta-narratives which we deploy and develop to explain social change. If we are no longer to be the puppets of the archive, then we're free to rethink how social change occurred. It may well be that at the end of the day, we think that an institutional approach which privileges the collective agency of groups defined by rules and forms of incorporation is precisely right. But for the first time, we will soon be in a position to interrogate other possibilities. We will soon be able to use the content of the archives we possess without being beholden to and seduced by their structure. For myself, I'm taking the opportunity of digitizing around, I think, about 10 or 20% of the surviving local government archive of 18th century London to ask the simple question, what does the world look like if you model social change as the outcome of individual interactions with institutions rather than as a game of billiards with institutions playing the balls? What happens when you decenter the institutions and the archives in favor of the individual? If the paupers of London, for example, connived at the provision of expensive health care and that care was then provided, I think we can legitimately say that the institutions become epiphenomena of historical change rather than actors in it. In the process of generating the evidence for this argument, I very much hope to turn history upside down. In relation to the theme of this seminar, it seems worthwhile to remind people that the process and the project they are engaged in cuts to the core of many aspects of both professional and cultural practice. It is simply not enough to say it is possible or even that it is inevitable without also asking whether it is desirable.